And good afternoon. The time is 12:07. This is Midday Matters on WBOY Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter. Very glad to be with you on this Monday, February 11th. Today on our program, a little bit later, I should say, we'll be remembering Bishop Emeritus John Darcy, who recently passed away. In the first part of the program, though, we'll be talking vocational education and what can we do to expand and improve it. With me in studio here, it's one of the usual suspects, Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. Bob, thanks for being with us once again.
Good to be here.
And we want our listeners involved here as well. If you have a question or comment, do give us a call, 260-452-1185 or 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. Joining us in studio for the first segment of our program, Tom Lewandowski. Tom, you've been on our program before. Thank you very much for being here.
Good to be here again.
It's from give me the full title here, because
okay.
I always get it wrong.
I don't want to throw you. Northeast Indiana Central Labor Council.
That's right. We appreciate you being with us here as always, Tom. Also with us in studio, it's Larry Gerardo, the principal at the Anthus Career Center in Fort Wayne. Larry, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Bob Kaler, I know you wanted to start us off here.
Okay. The reason we wanted to talk to you guys today is probably the bill that's getting the most enthusiastic reception at the State House is Senate Bill 465, which would create regional work councils to take a look at the state of vocational education, particularly at the high school level, and then ideally, after analyzing that, by the end of the year, they would suggest some changes and maybe reorient some of the course offerings. And it's occurred to me that I'm hearing a huge amount about this from people in Indianapolis who think that it's a great approach to increasing the quality of the workforce. But I haven't heard very much from people who actually train young people to join the workforce. So I thought you guys would be in a good position to tell us a little bit more about it. So why don't we start with you, Larry? How many kids are enrolled at Anthus?
Well, year in and year out, we're between about 900 and 950 students at the Anthus Career Center. We service all of the high schools in Allen County and Columbia City and Cherubusco in Whitley County. We also have students actually that are homeschooled that do attend the Career Center. So we have a pretty diverse group of students who choose as juniors and seniors in high school to take a program at the Career Center to really explore as well as build skills in a particular career area. We have 10 different departments. We have approximately 30 programs within those 10 departments. We're located downtown Fort Wayne at the old Central High School as our primary campus. We've got three buildings in that area, an auto building, a construction building, and also our main building, which houses most of our programs. But we do have a program at Smithfield that we partner with Ivy Tech, which is in aviation maintenance, a two-year program. And we're also at the Public Safety Academy. We have a firefighting program and a criminal justice program that are housed at the Public Safety Academy.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how many choice? Yeah, well, you mentioned a lot of locations, a lot of places students can go to further this training, learn a little bit more. Can you tell us a little more specifically about the programs that Anthus offers? How a larger variety there is?
I could go the entire list of program areas, but I've mentioned a few already. We also have IT programs, health, medical, dental programs. We also have a culinary program, early education. That would be the majority of the programs. I probably missed a few. The benefit of the of a program like this is that you're immersed in a professional environment. Actually, students come for 3 hours of their school day, so they spend half their school day with us. They're able to achieve industry certifications by the end of their programs if they pass that testing. So an A-plus computer repair student would take an A-plus exam at the end would be an example of that. Also, all of our programs offer dual credit through Ivy Tech or Vincennes. So students really are taking a college-level program, no matter what program they're in, a college entry-level program as they take a high school program.
So are there students who want to get into certain program areas at Anthus who don't have the chance because there isn't room?
We have some programs that are full each year. Our medical careers program would be a good example. We generally have more applications than we do spots for students. In most of the programs, we can accommodate most students. Medical careers would be an area. Culinary, some years, is overbooked. Our cosmetology is overbooked each year. There are certain IT programs that fill up. Most programs, most students can get in.
So what are the bottlenecks in meeting student demand? And does student demand dovetail with employer demand, as far as you can tell? Are there too many students in certain areas? Cosmetology comes to mind compared to the demands of the workforce.
Actually, we have in our first year cosmetology program, generally we enroll 34 students, and okay. We limit it to 34 students. Generally, we lose some 6 to 8 students over the course of the first year, so you would be looking at 26 in the next. And actually, that's a very, very competitive program. You know, I would say at this point, too, you know, one of the great things about high school career and tech ed is not only are we giving students an opportunity to actually earn industry licensure or certification or dual credits at the community colleges, but we're also introducing them to concepts that are harder to quantify, like how you become a professional. If you could see students who are immersed in these programs, including cosmetology, over the course of a year or two in some of their cases, because some of the students do take programming for 2 years in the same area, and see the growth personally as well as professionally, those students are better prepared. I mean, nationally, the research says that if you take a solid high school academic program, that's in English, math, science, etc., and you take career and technical education, and it doesn't matter which career and technical education program you take, if you do that, you will be more successful than a student who takes just a strong academic program and moves on, or a student who just takes a career and tech ed program emphasis and moves on with not as strong an academic program. The two combined are very powerful because of the experiences. Students all work with community. We have a ton of community partnerships, hundreds of community partnerships. Most of our students actually do an internship during their first year with our programs. An early education student is 3 times in the community actually working in that area. Our medical career students all do internships during the first year they're in medical careers. And we have 3 different programs. All 3 programs do that. And I could go on about that, but the personal growth that students achieve by taking high-level curriculum and having a teacher teach, and they are from the career field, and then intersecting with community regularly in several different ways, is a powerful model for learning and also personal growth.
I want to talk to you, Tom, for a minute about another avenue of vocational education that I haven't heard too much about in this discussion because it deals with public schools, but how many people learn skilled trades through traditional union apprenticeship journeyman programs and things like that around here?
I can't quantify it, but they're still the, particularly the building construction trades, joint apprenticeship training programs are strong. And the difference is that the workers within that union have some significant say in these joint apprenticeship training programs with employers about what the programs are. So in adult education, these are 50-50 kinds of propositions. And so the
what do you mean when you say a 50-50 proposition?
That on the joint apprenticeship training programs, both the employers and the union members design the curriculum.
Oh, okay.
And implement the programs so that what the tradesmen say is we want to get guys on and gals that will pay our pension. So they have a real interest in seeing that, not just that I see a lot of things that come in government training that are, they're just about, let's see what the numbers are. Well, they say, no, we want to see these people are going to be paying our pension 20, 30 years down the road.
Looks like we have a caller here on the line. Let's open the phones. And of course, if you want to get in touch with us this hour, the number is 260-452-1185 or toll free at 800-471-9264. Let's open the phones and go to Daniel. Daniel, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Yes, good afternoon. So as far as those future jobs, have there been studies, or perhaps the knowledge is already known, for the different regional labor councils for which industries will be growth industries, such that in each region maybe they could focus on being ready for what's in the pipeline? In the interest of full disclosure, I'm a volunteer with the NH3 Fuel Association, but I have a vision that in our area, even there's enough big infrastructure to allow for, if enough people saw the potential of it, to have a regional NH3 or ammonia economy similar to a hydrogen economy. So, of course, if you can avoid chicken and egg, put supply and consumer on the same side, but a bit of a story there, but kind of the idea of regional new industry kind of things that maybe the instruction can point towards.
And let's put your question to the panel here, Daniel. Gentlemen, any insights onto growth industries or what we need to be looking toward to grow this economy in the future?
I don't think it's going to take a lot of original research by the people who are involved in these councils. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is always the place to start. It breaks down jobs pretty thoroughly, and beyond that, the Northeast Indiana Regional Partnership has invested considerable energy into identifying hot growth sectors and, you know, the strong, steady standbys that help power the economy in this region.
Gentlemen, do you agree, Larry Girardo?
Yes, certainly at the high school level, we've been looking at the STEM area, the science, technology, engineering, and medical. That's been around for a few years now in this region, that those areas have been identified as key growth, job growth areas. Certainly, the partnership is trying to attract businesses to this area in those areas.
All right. Daniel, we appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. 260-452-1185 or 800-471-9264. Need to take a quick break here. We'll continue the discussion with Larry Girardo and Tom Lewandowski when we return. In the meantime, we'd love for you to get in touch with us. You can always call those numbers, email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. Stay with us. It's Midday Matters.
The There's plenty of death, corruption, and decay in Detroit, as well as hope and inspiration. And no one tells Detroit stories quite like journalist Charlie LaDuff. On the next Fresh Air, he talks about his hometown.
We're alive here, people. Everybody in Detroit is going to be fine. Still a city.
LaDuff's new book is Detroit, An American Autopsy. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
We're hitting the streets this week to celebrate what else? Mardi Gras in New Orleans and beyond. Hear from a Skull and Bone Gang, Baby Dolls, Mardi Gras Indians, and jazzy folks of all kinds. And learn why flamingos flock to Baton Rouge around this time of year. Plus lots of great Mardi Gras music. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Monday night at 7 on WBOI.
It's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm Melissa Blogg. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech. It's an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union address.
Tuesday at 9 p.m. here on WBOI.
It's time to...
Hi, I'm Jillian Meekin. Mark your calendar. We're going live at C2G Music Hall with another special Meet the Music broadcast on Thursday, February 21st, where we all have the best seat in the house. And this two-hour live show features Fred Rothert and Jill Mozina, Mark Maxwell saxophone duo, and Fair Fiola. That's C2G Music Hall, 323 West Baker Street. It's fun, it's free, and we hope you can join us there Thursday, February 21st at 7 to Meet the Music.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Indiana Tech Law School, opening in Fort Wayne, August 2013. Information on admissions and curriculum online at indianatech.edu/law or 855-TECH-LAW. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Reinbold and Anderson, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC, local financial advisors who help people just like you. More information on Reinbold and Anderson on the web at reinboldandanderson.com.
It's 12:25. You're tuned to Midday Matters on WBOI Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter, along with Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. During this part of the program, we're talking about vocational education in Indiana. A bit later on, we'll remember Bishop Emeritus John Darcy, who recently passed away. In the meantime, we want you to get in touch with us. What do you hope to see in the expansion or in the growth of vocational education here in northeastern Indiana? Give us a call to 260-452-1185 or toll free at 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. With us in studio to chat about this subject today, Tom Lewandowski from the Northeast Indiana Central Labor Council and Larry Gerardo from Anthus Career Center in Fort Wayne.
Tom, I want to come back to this idea of how unions and employers together educate people in skilled trades and prepare them for that. Do you see a role, do you see any way that work councils, as proposed in this legislation, might further what seems to be a pretty well-established system in apprenticeship and...
Well, these works councils, from what I can see so far, and the legislation seems fairly vague at this point, but from what I understand, the works council model, as practiced in Europe, is a tripartite, that there's business, government, and workers involved in the works councils. as I see it proposed now, this is bipartite. This is government and employers involved. And so the workers are cut out of the equation. And I think that if these works councils are going to be effective on the ground and really represent what's going to motivate people, then workers have to have a place at the table, and a significant place, because a lot of the talk about job training, and you mentioned this off air. There's this common lament from employers: we can't find employees to fill the jobs. What they don't often do is finish that sentence at what we're willing to pay. So if the workers are involved in this, you're more likely to get a real assessment of what the labor market looks like, rather than just leaving it to employers and the government.
Realistically, in a post right to work environment where relations between politicians at the state level and labor unions are probably at the low point in our lifetimes, mm-hmm. do you see any likelihood of organized labor getting a voice in this?
No, I don't. I don't think that it's likely, but I think it's why this effort would founder, though, until there's a realization that this isn't about the politics of it. It's just about what's going to work. If you don't have the people who are affected by it at the table, it's just going to be a fantasy.
So if even if labor doesn't have a direct voice in the way this is set up, let alone a major guiding voice, are there advantages or benefits that you could see coming from directing more money and more attention to high school level vocational ed? And how would you make the most of that?
Well, I think one of the things that Larry said that was really made a lot of sense for especially a lot of sense for what happens in the labor market, and the previous caller had talked about this, anticipating where the jobs are going to be. You've got to make sure that core is solid, yeah. And that if you match that core up with workplace experience, you end up with somebody who has real savvy on the job and is a good employee and somebody who ends up paying taxes and being a good worker. So our primary concern is let's get the foundation together, and any kind of workplace experience married to that is a plus. But it's hard to see from my perspective, because I don't get into anything but adult education.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not my turf.
Just to be clear, are most people who would go into apprenticeship programs are young adults, like probably in their late teens to 20s.
They're a little older now than they used
really?
To be. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Let me get back to you, Larry, for a minute. Tell me some more about what work Anthos has done that may provide some guidance to a work council, a regional work council that's trying to assess the fit of vocational education to available jobs?
Well, a couple of things along those lines. I would hope there would be good communication, as Tom mentioned on his end, good communication with the programs that are currently in our region. We've been doing a lot of work over the last 4 years. The Indiana Department of Education has asked all career and tech programs to come into line with what we call career pathways. So we've all done community education. State officials have come together in committees from around the state Business and industry folks have joined those committees, and we have developed pathways to follow with common standards, common end of pathway examinations, which is the accountability piece in career and tech ed these days. We have all agreed and developed partnerships with community colleges, Vincennes and Ivy Tech in particular, to offer dual credits to our students throughout the state in career and tech ed centers. And we offer industry certifications. Now, we've been working on that for the last 4 years. This is our fifth year that we're currently in. And starting next year, all programming is to be a part of this pathway. So we've done a lot of work, and I would hope that any regional boards would be looking at the kind of work we've been doing. There was a time where career and tech ed, education in general, didn't have a lot of community partnerships. But those times ended a few years ago, half a dozen years ago or more. Career and tech ed probably longer than that. But we have some good partnerships in the community. All career and tech ed centers, for instance, have advisory boards in each of their program areas. That include business and industry, post-secondary folks that help to advise them on equipment purchasing, curriculum, new technology that's coming down the pike. We start our all-school advisory, which is a board that includes a member from each of the department areas that we have. We start each meeting with a go-around the table. And a person from the auto industry will talk about, you know, what are the current employment opportunities? You know, what's pay look like out there? What's, you know, to give us at the Career Center, to give the leadership at the Career Center an opportunity to hear from each. And we do the same thing with our department advisory board meetings also. So in, you know, on a level, certainly having a regional group that would be willing to support career and technical education and would help us promote. You know, there's one area that I have felt like we haven't put enough money into, and that is that parents and students, our region in general, the average person in our region really doesn't know a lot about economic development, really doesn't have a lot of information about what it takes to get into certain careers, what certain careers pay. We've got a great manufacturing environment in this region, for instance, as an example. Yeah. And that is one of the areas that we hear oftentimes that there are jobs, but folks that aren't prepared for those jobs. I think part of the reason for that is that folks don't really know what the current manufacturing environment is like, for instance. Folks that look at that, parents of students, will say to themselves, it's the 1950s, the 1960s kind of environment, and it is no longer, in most situations, that kind of environment.
So how successful are ANTHIS students at finding careers in the fields that they've studied within, say, 6 months or a year after they graduate, if they don't have more education at post-secondary level that they need to get?
While they're with us, we certainly make sure they understand that no matter what route they go, they're going to have to continue to learn. Whether they go into industry right away or they go on to further education. And most, over 50%, go on to some additional education. So they'll go to 4-year schools, 2-year schools, apprenticeships. They'll move on into industry and get additional certifications, things like that. So we really try to, in today's world, you have to keep learning or you aren't employable. So we really push that. In terms of our numbers of students who are involved in the military or involved in post-secondary training of some sort is at the 60% level 1 year out.
So a year after graduation, they're 60% of them are either in the military,
yes,
and where often they would be taking advantage of what they've studied or continuing to learn in post-secondary. What about the other 40%?
Well, it's difficult for us to track students beyond. That's always been a difficulty for secondary schools to track that information. At the state level, we're held accountable for specific things like graduation rate and whether or not students are engaged in, you know, education or work after high school. It's difficult beyond that first year because the state tracks that for us the first year. So it is difficult to know exactly where those folks are. What we find is that initially some of them are working part-time. Some are not gainfully employed. And it has been difficult. What we found the last year or so is that more are able to take advantage of employment right out of high school in the last year than they were the previous years, previous 3 years. So that has been on the uptick. Some of our construction students are now getting jobs, for instance, again, out of high school. They have a very strong connection to community in the construction area, for instance, at the Career Center. Their advisory board is very strong, and we do some pretty good things. We've got a great program with the city right now, for instance, with our juniors and seniors, that is a real positive for our kids.
Tom Lewandowski, I want to ask you about something Larry just mentioned here. In terms of growing and expanding this type of training, both for young people and for adults, do you see the same type of narrative with, say, adult training, that folks just don't know that certain careers might be available or certain training might be available to get them down career paths that may be in demand in Northeast Indiana?
Well, there have to be jobs first. And that's been sort of an unaddressed issue in a lot of training, whether you're coming out of with a four-year degree and $80,000 in debt, there have to be jobs. And people are not willing to invest where there isn't a realistic chance to have a job.
Not interested in investing either say in college or in other
anywhere.
Types of career training.
Anywhere. They don't want to invest their money, they don't want to invest their time if there isn't really a job there. So if that part isn't there, a lot of this is just wishful thinking.
We need to wrap up this part of Midday Matters in just a moment, but I want to ask you both before we go, as we continue, you know, this discussion at the local level, at the state level, and more broadly, I'll start with you, Larry Girardo. What do you hope to see come to fruition in the next few years to help expand vocational education, to help get more people involved, or at least more people aware of what, say, a place like Anthus does?
In this region, Fort Wayne and other school corporations are putting an emphasis on career exploration and planning from middle school through high school. Eventually, I hope that filters down actually to elementary. You know, the research is clear that if you have a plan and you're able to try some things out as you go through high school, and you leave high school, you have a plan, and that plan shouldn't be default, and I think Tom was mentioning there, it shouldn't be default college only. We should value all work, and we ought to give students an opportunity as they go through school, which we are doing a much better job of these days, I think, in schools throughout the region, of helping them see what the possibilities are for them. You know, the days of, as Tom said, coming out of school with all kinds of debt and no possibility for jobs really should be over. If you're going to college, it ought to be for a reason. If you're going into the trades, it ought to be for a reason that you've had an opportunity to do some exploration, to try some things on, and have a plan that has some possibility for success as you leave high school, which means then you've identified what your next steps will be, and you have a good reason for that, your chances for success are much better. So my hope would be that folks would do those kinds of things. And then along with that, continued support by the state with dollars that will help us provide programs like this.
Tom Lewandowski, same question to you. What are you hoping to see in the next few months and years as we continue the conversation?
I'm hoping to see more workers involved in the discussion, because it's they're the ones who this has to matter for. If they're not, this will end up costing a lot of money and going nowhere.
All right.
And that's simply it. It's we have to know this matters.
Tom Lewandowski, Larry Gerardo, thank you both very much for being with us on Midday Matters today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Coming up after the news break, we'll remember Bishop Emeritus John Darcy, who recently passed away. He was the former bishop of the Fort Wayne South Bend Catholic Diocese. Stay with us. It's Midday Matters.
Coming up in the week ahead, as the sequester looms, former Pentagon official Michelle Flournoy joins us to break down the defense budget. And Wednesday, our favorite presidential speechwriters, Paul Glastras and Peter Robinson, join political junkie Ken Rudin to review the State of the Union address. I'm Neil Conan. All that and more in the week ahead on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Lots of seafood at the supermarket has a label guaranteeing it's sustainable, environmentally friendly. But can you trust that label?
The bottom line is there are not enough truly sustainable fisheries on the earth to sustain the demand.
The economic and environmental battles over seafood later on All Things Considered from NPR News. All Things Considered airs weekday afternoons at 4 on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
There's plenty of death, corruption, and decay in Detroit, as well as hope and inspiration. And no one tells Detroit stories quite like journalist Charlie LaDuff. On the next Fresh Air, he talks about his hometown.
We're alive here, people. Everybody in Detroit is going to be fine. Still a city.
LaDuff's new book is Detroit, An American Autopsy. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Good afternoon. I'm Katie Anderson with WBOI News. The Federal Highway Administration is reviewing the prices Indiana paid to acquire land for highway projects across the state. The portion of the federal investigation conducted at the Indiana Department of Transportation's Indianapolis office concluded last week, but officials are still analyzing what they found. Similar reviews have stripped local governments of federal funds. The Star recently reported Indiana offered $7 million for 32 properties that its appraisers valued at less than half that amount. NDOT spokesman Will Wingfield says the agency follows state and federal laws for acquiring land and is working with the FHA on the review. Governor Mike Pence has told his top ethics officer to look into land acquisition payments to an NDOT official and his relatives. Indiana's highest-performing high school and college students could get some of their student loans paid back by the government if they teach in some of the state's neediest subjects and areas. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, those are the terms of legislation headed to the floor of the Indiana House.
Under legislation proposed by Indianapolis Democratic Representative Justin Moed, the state would pay back $9,000 in student loans after a graduate of an Indiana college teaches 3 years in a Hoosier school. To be eligible, participants have to graduate in the top 20% of their high school class or achieve an SAT or ACT score in the top 20th percentile and earn at least a 3.5 GPA in college. Moed says his bill is a way to incentivize Indiana's top students to join the teaching profession.
It gets them to stay here in Indiana and teach in a school in an area of need, whether it's STEM, science, technology, engineering, or math, special needs, or a geographic shortage area.
The program would apply to students who are high school seniors or younger beginning next year. As a result, Moed says the program wouldn't start paying out money until 8 years from now, meaning this year's bill doesn't have an appropriation tied to it.
We've got then the next 8 years to figure out, you know, the details. Is this going to be how wide of a net are we catching of students that are actually looking at doing this? And then we can base the appropriation based on that.
Moed says there are other details that also need to be worked out in the coming years, such as how the state will advertise the program to students and connect them with the jobs they'll need to fill. But he says by passing the initial legislation this year, it essentially starts the clock for students who could take advantage down the line. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
A Purdue Extension scientist says U.S. cattle numbers have dropped to their lowest level since 1952, following last year's record-setting drought. Agricultural economist Chris Hurt says central and southern plain states have struggled hardest as their drought forced ranchers to reduce their herds, but the eastern Corn Belt hasn't been immune. A U.S. Department of Agriculture report shows Indiana's beef herd has dropped by 18% since 2007. In 2012, the state lost 2% of the herd, or about 4,000 beef cows. Hertz says the beef industry has had to compete with other sectors for expensive feed and land that's being converted to corn and soybean acreage. Hertz says stopping the decline would require more rain and lower feed prices. You're listening to 89.1 FM WBOI. Now back to Midday Matters with your host, Sean Beter.
Good afternoon. It's 12 minutes before 1 o'clock. This is Midday Matters on WBOI Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter, along with Bob Kaler, and special thanks to Tom Lewandowski and Larry Gerardo once again for being here in the first segment of our program. Now we're going to switch gears a little bit. Bob Kaler, something we don't normally do on this program, but Bishop Emeritus John Darcy passed away recently, and we wanted to take a few moments in this program to remember Bishop Darcy and what he did for the community. And we will really want you to get in touch with us this during the last few minutes here as well. Share your thoughts, your remembrances of Bishop John Darcy by calling 260-452-1185 or 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. Bob Kaler, we have a special guest in studio for this part of the program.
We do. That's Rebecca Green, is the courts reporter at the Journal-Gazette, and her alter ego is a blogger who writes a magnificent blog about values and faith and morality. It's really fascinating, and I was especially struck by a piece that she wrote last week remembering Bishop Darcy. And so she's going to share a little of that with us, and then we may chat a bit.
Rebecca, thanks very much for being with us on the program today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about your some of your conversations with the bishop?
About 10 years ago, I was covering the bishop a little bit when the sex abuse scandal broke in Boston. And at that time, I was transitioning from being a dyed-in-the-wool Protestant, evangelical Protestant, to the Eastern Orthodox Christian Church, which is a very liturgical, ancient practice of Christianity. But I had a problem being a former Baptist. I never really had a comfort level around priests. And at the same time that I was kind of working through this issue in my own spiritual life, I was tasked with covering Bishop Darcy. And you couldn't really, even as a journalist, have an encounter or conversation with him without him taking an interest in you. It was almost impossible to ever maintain any kind of an objective distance. He was always very concerned with the people that he interacted with. And I believe very firmly that at that particular point in time, those interactions were foundational to my later conversion to the Orthodox Church.
We do want to remind our listeners to get in touch with us again. NIP or Midday Matters at NIPR.fm. So you've set up, you know, how you encountered the bishop. What was the nature of your conversations? Because there are a lot of really broad issues of faith and legality and all sorts of things wrapped up into this one man and his experience.
Correct. We would, you know, as I covered him, you know, from, you know, just the basic press conferences and things, there were also times when I would do more in person interviews and longer just conversations. And in those conversations, we had these kind of debates about hierarchy and the purpose of liturgy and the papacy and all these things. And in the end, there was a couple years where I didn't really cover him. And then when Pope John Paul II died, I was asked again to spend some time with him as he ministered to his flock. And during that time, we had some downtime, and we had a conversation in which I shared with him that I had converted to Orthodoxy. And he was very interested in that and very concerned as a pastor for why I had done that. And it was a very interesting and surprising conversation.
During those difficult times, I guess, for him, and certainly a time of change for you, did he strike you as somebody who felt the weight of his office?
You know, he did, but one of the things that I always really appreciated about him, and I touched on it in my blog post, was that I think he, just from a perception, that he wore the title of bishop, he took it very seriously, but it was basically just that he was just a pastor on a larger scale. And so he related to people individually like he would any parishioner. So he was the pastor of this whole area, regardless of whether you were Catholic or not. It didn't matter to him that at no point in time had I ever been Catholic. One of the things he said to me when we had this conversation was, "Oh, you should have come and talked to me about this. I'm a pastor."
Come and talk to the bishop.
To the bishop, right. I'm just going to, you know, come in and say, "Got a minute?" And he said that we were sharing a donut, strangely, in the rectory of the cathedral in South Bend. And I looked at him and I kind of laughed and I said, "You know, Bishop, you're not my pastor." And he just kind of smiled. And he was, you know, kind of, well, technically, no, but he was very, very intrigued by my journey and just his compassion, his concern for me as a fellow Christian, not a fellow Christian that shared his practice of faith, but as somebody who was honestly looking for a deeper faith, it was a really, really, really interesting relationship, I guess, as a journalist, you want to maintain that kind of a distance and an objectivity. And I always felt that he allowed that, but if he wanted to push that, poke that veil, he was going to ask you something ridiculously personal, and what are you going to do?
I had the feeling that he brought a lot of humor to his evangelical relationship with you.
He did. And one of the things that he, you know, I said to him in that conversation, I joked, he said, "You know, why didn't you become Catholic?" And I said, "Well, no offense, I'm not a big fan of the papacy." And so we had this, you know, this discussion about, you know, why and the schism. And it was almost like he and I, once I became Orthodox, we would have these conversations like we were going to personally deal with this 1,000-year-old rift.
How'd you iron that out?
Between,
anyway?
You know, Constantinople and Rome. But he honestly seemed to, like, seriously want to try to do that. And then he would invite Orthodox clergy to events at the cathedral. And I covered one of those events and I ran into him in the back and he's like, "Aha, Orthodox," you know, like, and what are you going to do? You know,
that's the hidden video that you don't get of a celebrity. That
like, did I just make news? I didn't mean to, you know.
We're talking in the last few minutes of the program here about Rebecca Green's conversation with Bishop Emeritus John Darcy. I guess he was not emeritus when you spoke with him.
No, not. And I, over the years, I shifted beats and I cover mostly just crime and courts. And we have a religion writer who now full time covers the diocese. But I missed covering him. Just mostly for selfish reasons, because you never knew, you know, when you're done asking the questions about, you know, the Capitol campaign or, you know, the role of bishops and priestly formation, which was a passion of his, that, you know, you never knew, you know, the conversation you'd have, baseball, law, it sparkling conversationalist. Never lacked for interesting things to talk about.
We just have about 3 minutes left in the program here. I'm curious, looking back at those conversations about how he affected you, about how he affected the community. I mean, what is his legacy? This community has had bishops before it. Kevin Rhodes is the current bishop of Fort Wayne South Bend. What's John Darcy's legacy in this community?
Well, as someone who's not Catholic, I don't mm-hmm. know that I would want to weigh in on that too much. But just to say, as somebody who's a fellow Christian in the community, I think he made the Catholic Church much more approachable to the community, to the non-Catholics in the community. And I think his legacy as somebody who was very concerned individually with the souls and the well-being of rich and poor, the powerful, the downtrodden, anybody in the community, I in casual conversation since my blog post and since his death, just that kind of that idea that he really was, I think, the community's pastor in a very real sense.
I want to go back to something. Well, something you just mentioned here. You mentioned earlier as well. I mean, his role as pastor, as you say, of the whole community. That's interesting to me, because what was his, what did he see as his role in the broader community, not just within the Catholic Church here?
I think he saw himself as a person whose job it was to portray the love of Christ. And not just an administrator of this really big organization that some people you love or you hate, kind of. I mean, no one has ambivalent about it, and I think he really wanted to be the hands and feet of Christ to Fort Wayne, South Bend.
Well, we're just about out of time here, but Rebecca Green, we appreciate you being with us on Midday Matters today.
Thanks for having me.
And if folks want to check out your blog, how can they do that?
It's at rsgreen30.wordpress.com. And to be clear, the opinions expressed there in no way reflect my employer or are the opinions of my employer.
All right. Well, Rebecca Green, thank you very much again for being with us. We appreciate it. Bob Kaler, thank you very much for being with us once again as well.
Another fine Monday. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks also to Tom Lewandowski of the Northeast Indiana Central Labor Council and Larry Gerardo of Anthus Career Center. We appreciate you being with us today. Also, thanks to our listeners for tuning in and for getting in touch with us this hour. I'm Sean Beter, and this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1, streaming online at NIPR.FM. This is WBOI Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. Coming up on 1 o'clock, Fresh Air with your local host, Katie Anderson, is up next. Have a great day, everybody.